This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name's Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 21st of January 2009, I introduced the fifth session of the General Theory Reading Group, with a talk on the theme Aggregate Demand Part 1, The Model. The talk is based on books 3 and 4 of the General Theory and the corresponding chapters of my own book, The Economics of Keynes, A New Guide to the General Theory, published by Edward Elgar. You can also download a PowerPoint presentation to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening. In my previous talks last term, I devoted what may have seemed an inordinate amount of attention to books 1 and 2 of the General Theory. I did so because book 1 sets out the essence of Keynes's argument, while book 2 spells out his method, especially his treatment of time and equilibrium. To recap very briefly, the General Theory is a theory of employment as determined by the principle of effective demand, which Keynes intends to supersede the classical notion of general equilibrium. Effective demand is the equilibrium determined by Keynes's aggregate supply and aggregate demand functions, which bear no resemblance to those you find in textbooks. After what he calls the digression of GT Book 2, in Books 3 and 4, Keynes develops the principle of effective demand he has outlined in GT Chapter 3 by addressing the two components of the aggregate demand function, the demands for the production of consumption and capital goods, respectively. He will return to the aggregate supply function in Book 5. Now, the separation of the discussions of consumption and investment into books 3 and 4 corresponds to the division between short-term and long-term expectation made in GT Chapter 5, which we covered in great detail last time. In this and the next talk, I will address aggregate demand by following this division between the two types of expectation in a slightly different fashion, rather than treating consumption and investment separately, as does Keynes. In this first talk, I will discuss what we might call the model of aggregate demand, and in particular, the three psychological functions which Keynes uses to link together income, consumption, investment, the rate of interest, and the quantity of money. That is, the propensity to consume, or consumption function, and the two schedules of the marginal efficiency of capital and liquidity preference. In the second talk, I will talk about the state of long-term expectation and its relation to these functions, under the title of The Dark Forces of Time and Ignorance. The model of aggregate demand is the part of the general theory that has been more or less received into modern macroeconomics, and its basic structure will be familiar to you all. At any rate, I am not going to deliver an exposition of what you should have learnt in the first year of your economics degree. Accordingly, this talk may be easier going through more familiar territory than we've traversed in previous talks, but not too easy. I want to concentrate on the puzzles, the bits which previous interpreters have found difficult or even rejected. And you'll not be surprised to hear that I think puzzles have a lot to do with Keynes's method. There are two main issues I want to look at: the nature of the multiplier and Keynes's classification of capital assets and their relation to the three macroeconomic functions. The key concept here will be what I call a hierarchy of liquidity. I'm not going to address what might be called the Chapter 11 critique of the downward slope of the schedule of the marginal efficiency of capital, since I believe this is resolved by the recognition that Keynes assumes continuous short-period equilibrium in a given state of expectation, as I've described in my previous talks. But I dare say this issue will come up in our discussion. So before we dive in, there's one preliminary point which must be clarified and which I touched upon at the end of the last talk. The aggregate demand function of the principle of effective demand is based on entrepreneurial expectations. However, in books 3 and 4, aggregate demand has become the expenditure of consumers and investors. Keynes could helpfully have been more explicit about this switch. But the coupling between expectations and expenditure, between effective demand and income, cannot be made formally exact when production takes time. Since by the time final output is delivered, the state of expectation will almost certainly have changed as a result of changing views about the long-term future. Nevertheless, it is realistic to link today's aggregate demand, that is what I have called dealers' expectations, with today's expenditure, because today's consumption depends mainly on the income of the factors of production. And that income is fixed when they are employed and equals the effective demand for their services. While the consumption of entrepreneurs out of profits, especially in the case of corporations and their shareholders, is likely to be insensitive to minor differences between expected and realised income. It's this to which Keynes refers when he writes in his 1937 lecture, "Income, i.e. realised results as distinct from effective demand, only exists for entrepreneurs, and for them is relevant only because it reacts on their subsequent determination of effective demand and on their personal consumption. Thus it was that I came to lay all stress on effective demand as the operative factor. I found I could get all that was required by the conceptions of effective demand and income, which were identical for factors, but income of entrepreneurs at any time depended on the outcome of prediction undertaken at various previous periods under influence of effective demand." He refers to these differences between expected and realised income in Book 3 as windfalls. And in effect, he excludes them from the consumption function because they are, by their nature, unpredictable. This exclusion does not mean that windfalls are unimportant, merely that they cannot be modelled. The benefit of this exclusion is the consequence that factor income and effective demand are of equal value. Even though they are of completely different kind, so that it becomes possible to model the interaction of investment, consumption, and income. But let us never forget that factor income is determined by expectation and not directly by expenditure. Without the concept of effective demand, it's not possible to demonstrate how supply and demand can determine expected prices as equilibrium values at any time. It's not possible to define the state of expectation in a precise fashion, or indeed to sustain Keynes's principle as an alternative to the classical notion of general equilibrium on the common assumption of perfect competition. Indeed, that theoretical failure is precisely the experience of old Keynesian economics. So let's turn to the multiplier, which must be the economic concept for which Keynes is most famous. Yet that association is rather ironic, since the basic idea was introduced by Richard Kahn in 1931, and it is arguably Kahn's exposition of the multiplier as the limit of a convergent series of rounds of expenditure, income and leakages over time that was incorporated into old Keynesian economics. Furthermore, it's the Swedish concept of equilibrium as the fulfilment of expectations, which is the motor that moves the old Keynesian system from one position of equilibrium to another, over time, through the multiplier process. Yet, as we have seen, for Keynes, income and employment are both, at all times, equilibrium values. And the ex ante, ex post story has nothing to do with it. Keynes insists that the logical theory of the multiplier holds good continuously, without time lag, at all moments of time. He regards it as an error to confuse the multiplier with the dynamic traverse to a new position of long-period employment after a change in the state of expectation, which we discussed at length last time. So if we disentangle Keynes from Kahn and the Swedes, what can we say about the nature of the multiplier in the general theory? Recall once again that Keynes's ultimate objective is to show how the equilibrium of a competitive monetary production economy is determined not by the supply of available labour, but by the principle of effective demand. In the classical system, the division of output between investment and consumption is determined by time preference and the rate of interest, while output itself is essentially determined in the labour market by the second classical postulate, by the equilibrium between the marginal product and the marginal disutility of labour. Modern intertemporal macroeconomic theory has integrated these choices together into a unified mathematical framework. In Keynes's system, by contrast, consumption is determined by current investment without reference to the supply of available labour through the level of income. The equilibrium between current investment and consumption is reflected in the, quotes, multiplier, unquote, relationship between current investment and income. So this multiplier relationship must be understood as, in the first instance, a competitive equilibrium condition or relation between aggregate income, current investment and consumption that follows directly from the definition of aggregate income as the sum of the values of current investment and consumption. The multiplier is a corollary of the existence of a market value for aggregate output. In other words, of the temporary equilibrium of the daily market period, in Marshall's terms. The existence of a market value for aggregate output corresponds both to the traditional Marshallian conditions for the stability of market period price equilibrium in each industry and to a value of the marginal propensity to consume below unity. This fundamental psychological law, as he puts it, follows simply and directly from the observation of a set of market prices for output. And it's therefore, as Keynes states, a matter of a priori logic, not an ad hoc assumption. That's fairly dense, and for once this is seen most clearly in mathematical terms. Though in a presentation like this, I'll just give you the results, and you'll have to take the workings on trust, or look in my book, or the extract on my website. First, we recognise the national income identity, Y equals C plus I, as a market period equilibrium. The traditional multiplier can be obtained by differentiating that. And the stability condition, is that the marginal propensity to consume is less than one. Now, if we make the relative prices of consumption goods explicit, we can write the multiplier in two forms, corresponding to demand, this first one, and to supply. And these two expressions for the multiplier must be equal in market period equilibrium if market prices are struck. I won't pretend to take you through the workings, but basically it's the same thing. It's the multiplier expressed with the relative prices explicit. And the expression at the bottom is the standard Marshallian condition that the slope of the industry demand curve must be less than the slope, less than in absolute terms, than the slope of the supply curve for the equilibrium price to be stable. More formally, the condition for aggregate money income to be defined is equivalent to the condition that in each industry, the market period price elasticity of demand is less than the market period price elasticity of supply for normal goods, provided that the aggregate income elasticity of the supply price is less than or equal to the aggregate income elasticity of the demand price. These latter two elasticities do not appear in Marshall. A priori, one would expect the second half of the condition to hold as an inequality below full employment, and the strict equality to hold at full employment. It's conceivable, as Keynes puts it, that individuals were so tête-monté in their decisions as to how much they themselves would save and invest respectively, that there would be no point of price equilibrium at which transactions could take place. In this case, our terms would cease to be applicable, since output would no longer have a definite market value. Prices would find no resting place between zero and infinity. But he goes on to say, experience shows, however, that this in fact is not so, and that there are habits of psychological response which allow of an equilibrium being reached at which the readiness to buy is equal to the readiness to sell. That there should be such a thing as a market value for output is at the same time a necessary condition for money income to possess a definite value and a sufficient condition for the aggregate amount which saving individuals decide to save to be equal to the aggregate amount which investing individuals decide to invest. So to sum up, the multiplier is in the first instance a static equilibrium concept that follows directly as a matter of logic from the assumption of perfect competition and the observation of a market value for output at any given point in time. If the consumption function is assumed to be stable, with all the usual caveats about comparative statics, one can go on to estimate the change in income that follows from a change in investment over time. Yet the multiplier itself is no more a matter of a process through time than is the point of effective demand. Indeed, I have no doubt that the confusions surrounding the two concepts are intimately related. So let me now turn to investment and what I call the hierarchy of liquidity. One of the axioms of classical economics is the idea that under perfect competition, every good is to some degree and at the right price a substitute for every other, either directly in exchange or indirectly through production. In the general theory, by contrast, goods are divided up into the separate categories of money, bonds, consumption goods, and capital goods. Think of each category as a different compartment in an old-fashioned railway carriage without a corridor, divided by partitions. The three partitions between the four compartments correspond to Keynes's macroeconomic functions, the propensity to consume, and the schedules of the marginal efficiency of capital and of liquidity preference, which do not replace but complement Marshall's microeconomic supply and demand functions. The three capital asset compartments themselves also share a larger compartment, or if you like, a carriage, with consumption goods coming along behind in the guard's van, or caboose as they call it in North America. As Keynes puts it on page 166, an individual faces two separate types of decision involving time preference. There's a sequence down the screen so that an individual must take two separate steps. First, the decision to consume income or wealth. And then the decision as to the form in which to hold wealth, old and new. The sequence also operates, as we shall see, within the wealth box, so that money dominates bonds, and bonds dominate capital assets. This is the hierarchy to which I referred. It might actually be better to show the sequence running this way, with consumption at the bottom. Then we see that in Keynes's system, money's at the top of the system, ruling the roost, with liquidity preference determining the rate of interest on bonds, and in turn, the marginal efficiency of capital determining the rate of current investment in capital goods. Current investment then determines consumption through income and the multiplier. Now, that's fairly straightforward, but it's of the greatest importance to realise that in the general theory, individuals do not choose between, say, consumption goods on the one hand and bonds or capital assets on the other, as in Fisher and Hicks, nor between money and consumption goods, as in Pigou and Friedman, nor between money and capital assets, as in Minsky, nor do employers as a whole substitute between labour and capital goods in choosing how to produce a given output, as in the classical aggregate production function. Each of these missing choices has played a role in the interpretive controversy, but they're all ruled out by Keynes's treatment of time. The common foundation of Keynes's three macroeconomic functions and his system of classification is our uncertainty about the future, and it's this which interferes with the gross substitution axiom of classical theory. This separation into compartments has nothing to do with obstacles to competition. In GT chapter 17, Keynes assumes that the price of each asset is held under perfect competition at the equilibrium point where the net advantage or total prospective return is the same. Our earlier discussion of the multiplier has made it clear that a marginal propensity to consume less than unity is in fact a condition of price equilibrium, and the existence of a market value for output, i.e. income, under perfect competition. These compartments are not about imperfect competition or ad hoc behavioural restrictions, but about the propensity to consume today when the future is unknown, and about differences in the effect of changing views about the future on each class of asset. As we noted earlier, the classical theory holds that the rate of interest, in some real sense, regulates the division of income between consumption and saving stroke investment. Balancing the impatience for consumption today against the greater consumption tomorrow arising from the productivity of capital. Thus, there is no partition between consumption and investment, as in the general theory, but an optimum equilibrium allocation over time of consumption, including leisure, based on relative prices. Keynes's critique of the classical theory of interest begins in chapters 6 and 7 with the definition of income as the value of output and with the investment saving identity. And in earlier talks, we've explored why the familiar old Keynesian concepts of equilibrium income and the equilibrium of ex ante and ex post saving, reminiscent of the classical approach, were rejected by Keynes. The prices and outputs of consumption and capital goods are always in competitive equilibrium, provided that output has a market value. And there's nothing left for the rate of interest or the quantity of money to do in bringing about equilibrium between these two aggregates. Chapter 14 approaches the same question from a different angle, emphasising that the investment and saving schedules implicit in contemporary classical thought are not independent of each other or of money income. So Keynes's partition between consumption and investment, embodied in the propensity to consume, is not an endogenous outcome, but an independent variable of his equilibrium theory of employment. GT Chapter 9 succinctly summarises the complex, long-term, subjective influences on the propensity to consume, most of which are not amenable to equilibrium analysis and depend greatly on psychological attitudes towards the future. Certainly, the propensity to consume bears no simple functional relation to the rate of interest in the short term. And as for the long term, Keynes is agnostic. He's quite clear that competition alone provides no self-regulatory process of adjustment which takes place without the necessity for any special intervention or grandmotherly care on the part of the monetary authority. So in moving from consumption to investment decisions, Keynes's choice of compartments and partitions within the wealth box is highly significant. He accepts that under perfect competition, the total prospective return at any time from holding any asset, new or old, is equalised. So that without the compartments, he would have no basis for causal analysis. In particular, no basis for picking out the money rate of interest as the significant variable. Try and make this point clearer. Imagine an asset other than money, whose total return is fixed exogenously. The effect of this would be to require that the total return from all other assets, including money, was held at the same level in equilibrium. If the money rate of interest were below this level, holders of bonds would be better off selling and buying other assets, thus reducing the price of bonds and raising the money rate of interest. In such a case, the causal analysis would need to explain why the return on the dominant asset should be exogenous and impervious to the forces of competition and substitution. The question, therefore, is how do market forces operate to determine the total return on all types of asset? And the sophisticated classical answer, avoiding the idea that capital has some physical productivity, the sophisticated answer as set out by Marshall and elaborated by Keynes in the rather entertaining chapter 16, relatively entertaining, is that the return on capital assets in general reflects their relative scarcity in exactly the same way as the return on land. Where Keynes and the classics part company is that the latter invoke the notion of weighting as the independent element of capital in general, which is in scarce supply. Pigou adds uncertainty bearing, an interesting halfway house between Marshall and Keynes. Since output is determined by full employment in the classical system, capital assets can be accumulated only if people are willing to postpone consumption in favour of investment. And because they're reluctant to do so without the inducement of a real rate of return, capital assets remain scarce and continue to earn rents. As Marshall puts it, everyone is aware that the accumulation of wealth is held in check and the rate of interest so far sustained by the preference which the great mass of humanity have for present over deferred gratifications, or in other words, by their unwillingness to wait. That's the classical view, obviously. Now, since waiting is not consuming, Keynes's identification of the investment-saving identity and its direction of causation that current investment determines saving deprives the increment of waiting of any independent causal influence upon the rate of investment, and therefore upon the scarcity of capital assets. So, if it's not the reluctance to wait, what is it that keeps capital assets scarce and their total return above zero? Keynes's answer is ultimately the same as that of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, that the love of money is the root of all evil. In contrast to Marshall, he writes that the world after several millennia of steady individual saving is so poor as it is in accumulated capital assets is to be explained, in my opinion, neither by the improvident propensities of mankind, nor even by the destruction of war, but by the high liquidity premiums formerly attaching to the ownership of land and now attaching to money. There's something about money which makes the money rate of interest fall more slowly than the total returns on other assets as they accumulate. This something turns out to be related to the changing views about the future to which a monetary economy is sensitive, and which he formalises as changes in the state of long-term expectation. Okay, so furthermore, this something attaches more strongly to money than to bonds, and to bonds more strongly than to real capital assets. So that on this dimension, bonds are always preferred to real capital assets, and money is always preferred to bonds. And we thus arrive at Keynes's three categories of asset and the two partitions between them, the marginal efficiency of capital and the state of liquidity preference. Keynes's objective is to establish a relation between investment and the state of long-term expectation through the combined mechanism of the two functions of the marginal efficiency of capital and of liquidity preference. The state of long-term expectation cannot itself be captured by a quantitative variable that can be put directly into a function. Unlike the rates of interest and of current investment and the quantity of money. Yet the state of long-term expectation is the substrate of the two asset functions themselves. The action in Keynes's system comes not primarily through movements along the curves caused by changes in the quantity of money, but through shifts in the state of long-term expectation and the related state of liquidity preference, and in the corresponding functions and positions of equilibrium. His technical achievement is to incorporate something as elusive as changing views about the future into a formal equilibrium framework. The reason why two functions are necessary emerges in GT chapter 17, of which, astonishingly, Hansen writes, "Not much would have been lost if it had never been written." The total prospective return on an asset can be divided between the prospective yield, Q, the carrying costs in terms of itself, C, and the liquidity premium, L, so that the total prospective return in terms of money equals Q minus C plus L plus A, where A is the expected appreciation in the money price of the asset. Keynes then divides assets into two groups, one comprising real assets and bonds, which offer a return in the form of a prospective money yield less carrying costs, so that's A plus Q minus C, and in the other camp, money, offering a return in the form of a liquidity premium, L. This segregation is a simplification, since Keynes allows that real assets and bonds may offer some liquidity, and that money may offer some prospective yield, and may incur carrying costs for safe custody, for instance. So the prospective yield, the carrying costs, and the liquidity premium are thus to be understood as defined net, relative to money or other assets, respectively. And for reasons that will become clear next time, bonds always have a higher liquidity premium than real assets, so that liquidity preference can properly be discussed in terms of the choice between money and bonds alone. Now, the purpose of this segregation of money from other assets is to isolate the liquidity premium on money as the rate which rules the roost and holds up the rate of return on capital assets in general. Keynes's argument requires that he identify separately the essential properties of money as distinct from other assets and connect these to the rate of current investment in capital assets, which, unlike money and bonds, can be produced by labour. And this is achieved by the separate definition of these two functions, of liquidity preference and of the marginal efficiency of capital, a distinction which is absent, or at least of no causal significance, in classical theory. So Keynes's choice of compartments and of the partitions between them is far from arbitrary, and the lack of substitutability between each compartment, except through the partitioning functions, has nothing to do with obstacles to competition. The classical axiom of gross substitution, which would dissolve the partitions between the compartments, can do so only by abstracting from the uncertainty about the future, which is the common foundation of Keynes's three macroeconomic functions. So in the next reading group session, we will look at the nature of this uncertainty in more detail. Let me sum up for today by noting once again that Keynes's model is one of equilibrium at a point in time. Today we've extended the description of the model to include the investment decision as well as the production decision, and to show how Keynes connects the preference for holding money the propensity to hoard in the old language, with the equilibrium level of employment. The level of current investment at any time is the equilibrium outcome of a forward-looking portfolio decision at a point in time, as all such decisions necessarily are. The level of consumption is an equilibrium outcome which reconciles investment, income, and the propensity to consume at any time. And it's the logical counterpart under perfect competition of observing a level of income. Now, I find this a remarkably elegant construction. The model is like a pantograph or an anglepoise lamp, if you like, in that a change in the position of one of the independent variables requires a corresponding change in the other variables, a position which will then be held until another change occurs. Technically, that's a static equilibrium model. But Keynes's achievement is to incorporate into such a model expectations about the future, which itself is open to modelling only in a very limited sense. George Shackle called Keynes's method kaleidostatics, by which he meant the temporary freezing of a continually shifting picture. Vicky Chick has used the analogy of a film, a moving picture made from snapshots, as films are, each snapshot systematically related to what has gone before. There are some formal dynamics in the general theory, as we discussed in depth last time, but it's probably safe to ignore them for most purposes, and certainly it's vital not to confuse them with the multiplier or with the formation of expectations. In this film, we can only predict what is in the next frame within a given state of expectation, as we might watch the image of a falling apple. What we cannot predict is the hand reaching in from outside the camera's field of view and catching the apple. So next week, we'll hear from Jeff Harcourt on the connections between Keynes, Joan Robinson, and the general theory. Joan had a great deal to say about the nature of time and equilibrium, and I hope Jeff will be able to tell us about that, as well as I've no doubt one or two stories in his usual fashion. But thank